Welcome to a new episode of God, It's Killing Me. This is a very special episode for us, not just because Rahul Desa and I are celebrating the first time Federer and Nadal met each other in a Grand Slam final, but also because this is the first time we have a guest on the show. So say hello to Art Kaushik, a massive Federer fan, and on top of that, a top guy and a top cricket writer. So hello, Kaushik. Thank you for joining us. And this is exactly what we needed here. Two Federer fans in a show discussing Federer losing.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Adi. Hi, Rahul. Thanks. I've obviously heard all the other podcasts before, and I think it's only fair that we have two Federer fans here, given which part of the tennis season we are entering.
Yeah, exactly. So, Adi, just one more thing about Kaushik. Like, Kaushik is, like, he loves his Federer just the way you do, in, like, this super geeky, nerdy way. But yeah, he's not as rabid. Like, you can sit with him in a press box, as I have. Like, for some reason, we've only toured together when there's some amazing tennis on. And I always sit next to Kaush and I give him a hard time. And he takes... Champ, unlike you, you fucker.
Yeah, so I suppose a lot of that comes down to the fact that both of you are sports journalists, and it's kind of your job to act sane when you're in press boxes and on tour and stuff. But you can be assured, if I was, you know, even accidentally a sports journalist, I would have made an absolute mockery of myself on every tour.
No, but that's not always true. Adi, if you remember that 2018 when Djokovic, I think, was playing Yoon Chung, and with Ravi Shastri was about to enter the press conference, and we were following the tie break there, and we were on a different world altogether.
That's actually absolutely right. And the fact that, like, once our tour got over, the test tour, and a bunch of us were going back, and Kaushik was one of the very few journalists who was going to stay back for the one-day leg as well. And between the two tours was the Federer-Cilic final. Yeah. And South Africa, RD, we got like some crazy, like, you know, bar owner in like downtown Joburg to open a bar for us at 11 in the morning. The premise that Indians drink a lot of beer. Show us Federer Cilic, and then Kaush showed up, and he's a teetotaler. So yeah.
okay. There's your answer there. I mean, I'm guessing the alcohol makes me that person, the rabid fan.
What do you think, we're drunk in the press box, sir? Right? Okay. So yeah, we are of course celebrating. As we said, Federer and Nadal meeting in a Grand Slam final for the first time. And this is, of course, the 2006 French Open. This is also the first time Federer has made a French Open final. And yeah, that's what we're going to talk about for the next however many minutes. Kaush?
Yeah, It was actually a pretty interesting time, because this is the first Grand Slam that Federer and Nadal played in the final. And it's actually 2 years, 2 years on from their Miami match. And if you remember, at the end of that Miami game, Federer almost sort of dismissed that defeat to Nadal and said, "We'll see how strong he is in 2 years." And here we are 2 years later.
Yeah, exactly.
Did he actually say that?
Yeah.
That sucks. First time in the final, and I remember sort of watching. I was watching this with you, unfortunately. back then, I think we watched it at our usual Pop Tates aunt in Andheri East, and this is the final where it became this running joke where. After it, I was so disgusted that I just threw a 500 rupee note onto the table, and you both went with it.
Yeah, I remember this, man. This is also, like, I don't know, there's just something about this time that was easily like one of the most fun times looking back in my life, because, you know, we had just finished college. I'd fucking managed to pass. I don't know how that happened. And I'd come back with a broken leg and a torn ACL from a very long tour. And the 2006 World Cup was about to start at the same time when the French Open was going on. And all of us kind of like got together and watched this in this pub with nobody except, I think, the four of you in a pub, this like, you know, with about like 250, 300 people believing that Federer even stood a chance. It was quite ridiculous. Like when I was watching it, like all these thoughts are coming back. And yeah, I don't know, man. Just generally a very, very pleasant time in life. Like, you know, we hadn't started working, and I guess I can speak for you too here, Kosh. You mustn't have, because you're much younger than us. What do you remember when you think of this match specifically, or 2006 specifically?
Yeah, I think 2006. So I think I just finished 10th. I was in 11th standard when this was happening. And it was not as pleasant for me as it was for you, because this whole Nadal thing was like really getting annoying now. It was no longer like, you know, one match or two matches. In fact, the whole build up to this French Open was Federer and Nadal having played four times before in the year already. in what there was in Dubai, then Monte Carlo, oh, I think three times, and then that Rome final of 2006. So this was right in the middle of my, you know, the Federer following days of, you know, logging in diligently every day to rogerfederer.com. And, you know, I hated it when that website would turn orange. So they had color coordinated the website homepage based on the tennis season that was in play at that time. And the minute it turned orange, it was like, oh, no, it's going to be Nadal, Federer all the time. And yeah, that wasn't all that good.
Does it
a little bit of yourself?
Sorry, didn't quite catch that.
That was to RD actually, because I was really reminded of like a younger Rahul Desai when I heard that. I mean, there's a lot of him in you.
I have to actually say our voices sound a little similar on here, so it feels like I'm sort of talking to a mirror image of my own voice. which is actually not such a bad thing. Kaushik, how much did, given that, you know, of course, the Federer had already lost to Nadal on a hard court by now once, like in Dubai.
Yeah.
Given that he was entering this French Open final as more or less the underdog, how much did that Rome final psychologically affect you as a Federer fan heading into this match?
Oh, actually quite a bit, because there was a lot of factors at play. Okay, so this was the Rome final was me at my peak Nadal hate phase, and this was the time I know I just found ways to dislike everything about him. There was this five-setter final which he lost after Federer lost after having match points. But apart from that, there was also this whole part of the match. You know, I remember watching this game where Federer even has, is that all right, Tony? And he shouts at Tony Nadal in the middle of the game. And there's a lot of confusion. And then later in the press conference, he's asked, were you talking to Tony Roche? And then Federer says, no, this is, I had to stop Tony Nadal from, you know, this whole on-court coaching thing. So I had developed this whole, oh, Nadal's the bad guy and Federer's the good guy and this thing. And then that final didn't do any good for me. It was, what it told me was even Federer at his best may not be good enough to beat Nadal on clay.
Yeah.
It was a sinking feeling, really.
Ayer?
Yeah, man, so I just generally think that Roger has a problem with his rivals' families. Like, this has happened famously or infamously with Djokovic's parents later on in life. And he really put them as, like, being these terrible influences, not just on Djokovic, but, like, on the circuit in general. And this is the first time I actually caught that, because I didn't know that Federer had a problem with Uncle Tony at this point. Kaushik telling me this was the first time when I caught a little glimpse of this during the commentary in the match that I was in the footage that I was watching, where they basically said that Federer had called Uncle Tony out for on-court coaching a couple of times, right? That's the same thing you're referring to, right?
Yeah, yeah. So so they met at the Monte Carlo final just a couple of weeks before, and there was a lot of references to Uncle Tony coaching Nadal in that game, but there was no incident as such. It was a routine win for Nadal in four. And then they come to Rome, and then they make the finals again. And I mean, obviously that match, they go on to play for over 5 hours. And it's probably the reason why we no longer have five set finals in the Masters 1000, or it's a big reason why. But, you know, at the end of the game, it was Roger who was pissed off, not just because he lost that game after having two match points on Rafa's serve, but it was I remember a lot of the press conferences that followed, and I did go back and check that as well, and I remembered right, because it was a lot worse being spoken about Tony Nadal's on-court coaching during that time. Yeah, Federer was pissed off quite a bit. And it's interesting because in heading until the French Open in 2006, Federer always addressed Rafa as Rafael in all his press conference.
There's no chamminess at this point.
Yeah, yeah. No, none of that right now.
Yeah, no, I can, I actually remember, and you know, when I was rewatching the match a couple of days ago, this French Open final, of course, even the commentators were mentioning the same on-court coaching thing, and as Kaushik very rightly said, the whole Tony thing. And you know, I just tried to put myself psychologically in Federer's place at that point, because you know, he's pretty much on autopilot for most of the year, and clay was that only surface where he was running into this wall. And by now, as a fan, psychologically, let me tell you where I was. Because the Rome final that happened, I was dead sure that, you know, first of all, he was the better player in that match. Secondly, he should have won that. Of course, this was the beginning of a very painful sort of relationship for Federer fans with lost match points over the years. Once that match got over, I was actually very sure of the fact that Federer would defeat Nadal at the French Open. Of course, you know, we were young and delusional at that point of time. We had no idea how good Nadal was on clay, because it was technically only his second year. He was only the defending champion once, as opposed to freaking 55 times that he is right now. So, I mean, I just thought that, okay, he's a great clay court player, and, you know, Federer is going to get him because it's about time he wins that damn, you know, all the four Grand Slams. It should have happened last year, but it should now happen this year. So, you know, when this final did start and when the first set went the way it did, for me, it was nothing surprising. I was like, okay, this is just going the way I thought it would. There's nothing that's going to stop him today. And little did I know I'd have to wait 3 fucking years more for that damn slam, that like entire Grand Slam. And this particular French Open was a reality check of like the bitterest form for me, especially when it came to the Federer-Nadal rivalry. Because again, as Kaushik said, no matter how well Federer plays on clay, it just dawned upon us that he might just never beat Nadal at the French Open. And we were right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what is he? 59-0. Wasn't that the record coming into... Paris? No. Yeah. Sorry. It was 53-0 coming into Paris.
Yeah.
Because after Rome is where he tied Vilas.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, then six straight matches to get into the final here to make it 59. Yeah, delusional, most certainly, man. I mean, like, what are you talking about? And even when he took the first set 6-1, I think, like, most of the people that I was watching it with, and like, we all had like our jaws to the floor, right? We were like, what is going on? Nadal looked completely off key. I mean, there was just something wrong with his game. He wasn't timing it right. It was very hard to put a finger on what it was. But as we discussed later that day as well, I think he was just, you know, the nerves of taking on Federer in a final. I mean, also think about it this way, right? Like, this is already built up to be the big rivalry of our times. and they've met just once in a slam. And, you know, in Nadal's first ever run to the not just the Grand Slam final and the trophy, but like the first time he was ever playing in the French Open. So, you know, you could be excused for really not knowing what like lay in store. This time he knew exactly the challenge that, you know, Federer brought to the table, not just, you know, in best of three matches or in hard court games where he was also finding a way to win in Miami and Dubai. But like you guys already mentioned, you know, the five-setter in Rome. Like, man, what the fuck? Like, you have to play a five-setter in the Slams and also in the Masters Finals. Like, this was an incredible time to be a tennis player, right? Because the endurance you needed to kind of like do this week in, week out, and especially during the clay leg, like a five-setter in Rome, and then you get like a four, five-day breather, and then you're back to like, you know, you're in Paris playing five-setters right through. I mean, they said, right, like Nadal and Federer had played the same number of sets going into the final, but Nadal had four and a half, five hours more.
Yeah.
It's a bit ridiculous. I think all of that kind of ensured that Federer won the first. But yeah, it was really just like hardcore lovers like you, Adi, who believed that Federer even stood a chance. Gosh.
Oh, yeah. And if I could just take a quick pot shot, it was no wonder Novak Djokovic used to retire so many times in those days. Which, and just to sidestep on that, and he actually did retire in that match against Nadal just on the... on the way to the final there for Nadal. But
sets, no?
Yeah, two sets, 6-4, 6-4, and then followed by one of the most bizarre press conferences you would ever see. Do you guys remember that?
No, not yet.
Djokovic comes out to the press conference after retiring 4-6, 4-6, and says, "I was in complete control of the game. Rafael Nadal is not unbeatable on clay. I can beat him." And then Nadal follows Djokovic to the press conference, like almost his presser is almost immediately after. And he asks for a couple of translations. And then he replies with, "Yes, he must be right."
the six, you know, honestly, like, of course, he beat Djokovic in the quarterfinal. And this was Djokovic's first quarterfinal ever. I think.
Wow.
And, yeah, I think. Okay. Yeah.
And Djokovic actually had quite a run, you know, because we were still so much in the Federer-Nadal phase at that point, because Nadal was sort of rising as the next challenger after, I hate to say it, but after Roddick. We were so sort of overwhelmed by that particular rivalry that Djokovic had already started making those very sort of dangerous runs under the radar, because he beat Safin, Gonzalez, Haas and Monfils on the way to the quarters. And that's really not like a small thing to do in 2006. Even though I didn't know, of course, Djokovic, you know, won a Grand Slam not too long later. And of course, he was very famous for retiring then. For the longest time, didn't he also like, wasn't there a bagel in that match between Nadal and Djokovic?
In the French?
Yeah, in the French, in this sport.
No, I think it was just 6-4, 6-4, and then he retired.
Right. So the match I actually most remember from this particular tournament before the final was the match between Rafa and Paul-Andre Mathieu in the third round. And I actually remember absolutely being blown away by the quality of that match, because I've never seen Paul-Andre Mathieu play that kind of tennis in his career. And we used to follow him quite a bit because he was on quite a... You know, he was quite the player back then across surfaces. So that match really stayed with me, and it went on forever, like 4 hours or something, just for those four sets. And he took the first set off Nadal. And I remember that Nadal is, you know, in a way, he felt vulnerable to me on clay because he's losing the first set quite often. When I say often, it's like three times or something. But the previous year in the final also, I think he had lost the first set to Poeta.
Yeah.
And again to Mathieu, he lost the first set. Then again, you know, he was a bundle of nerves against Federer in the first set, which he lost. I've never seen Nadal play a worse clay court set in my life than that Federer just ran through him because Federer wasn't doing anything extraordinary. He was just getting a lot of shots back in play, and Nadal was making the most Federer-like errors at the other end. So it was surreal, but you know, I won't say I was surprised.
Yeah, just to add to that, I thought Federer was running around a lot of his backhands in the first set instead of trying to, you know, tame that short slice or whatever, like instead of taking it around the shoulder. I thought of a lot of his points for the 25 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it lasted, when Nadal and if Nadal managed to target it properly, firstly, towards Federer's backhand side, he was just skipping around it beautifully. He stopped doing that from the second set onwards, but we'll come to that. Kaushik?
Yeah, it's true that my recollection is a lot similar to what RD had. It was basically Nadal playing like Federer, with, you know, dumping those backhands into the net very uncharacteristically. And he did have this problem with the first set. And it was a very interestingly, this was like the same French Open 2006 where Nadal was also blogging on the ATP website through the tournament. So, which was something that I used to follow. And then Federer would go on to do it later in the year at Tokyo. So, that whole Paul-Henry-Matthew game, Nadal writes about it as his racket stringer having strung it to a different tension. And, you know, any shot that he was playing was going almost 100 meters off direction. And then he had to get his new set of rackets in the middle. But yeah, and that pattern kind of followed into the rest of his games. Hewitt also, he dropped a set. And then I think he had a tough time against a very surprise semi-finalist there, Ljubicic. And then similar, it started. I mean, it was the first time he was defending Grand Slam champion. So I think that played a big part in Nadal starting the way he did it. Actually quite sluggish.
What do you guys think changed in the second set exactly? Because of course, Nadal stopped making those errors. And as Iyer even said, that Federer also stopped going around that backhand. But, you know, honestly, when I was watching it again, I sort of noticed that this was the beginning of sort of, not beginning, because it had happened the previous year. So Federer knew exactly what to expect. He knew his backhand was going to be peppered relentlessly. And I love the fact that Nadal actually did not change that strategy after the first set, despite being absolutely demolished 6-1, you know, because any other, probably a lesser player in the final on the big stage would immediately have to sort of rethink the entire pattern, the entire strategy, because clearly the backhand thing wasn't working because Nadal's serve wasn't working enough. It wasn't quick enough and Federer had enough time to sort of get around. But he did not change much except sort of just stepping it up. Like, I don't remember a lot of forehands off Federer. Like, I'm saying not even one shot properly in the second set where Federer actually had the freedom to hit his forehand. And I remember watching that when he did actually hit that forehand in between a long rally in the second set, when Nadal was sort of coming back into play slowly. I remember that as soon as Federer would hit a forehand, you could sense that the fact that he didn't make the most of the forehand, which in that context meant that he didn't go for an outright winner, was playing on his mind the very next shot when the ball would come back to his backhand. And that, at least as a Federer fan, like that I was noting, like on a very psychological level, I was sort of noticing that Federer in between rallies was having sort of a mental battle with himself, because he constantly kept feeling that, I feel like he kept feeling that, you know, he wasn't doing enough with his own forehand. And of course, the surface had a very huge role to play, as we'll learn later when they face each other on other surfaces, because those same forehands used to really push Nadal to the back of the court on any other surface. Here, it really wasn't doing much.
I have another answer also listed down for what caused the turnaround in the second set.
I know where you're getting.
Do you know where I'm getting to?
Yes. This unnecessary sportsmanship.
Yes. Unnecessary.
Oh, I hate that moment. I remember almost wanting to switch off my TV after that game. Go on. I don't want to relive that.
Yep. So I remember very, very, very... I mean, you know, there are some moments that just come back to you when you're rewatching these matches. Mm-hmm. And this one is all about Rahul Desai for me, actually, from back in the day, from almost 15 years ago. Because okay, let me paint the picture, and it'll probably come back to RD too. So Nadal has held quite easily to kick off the second set, and Federer is serving 40 love up. And there's a medium to longish rally where a Rafa forehand kind of like sails long. You're not sure if this happens, but the linesman calls it out. And the chair umpire does not, change the decision. But Roger, for some reason, goes like, I think this ball caught the line.
Fuck's sake.
And Chairam comes out and he's pointing away from the chalk, from the paint. And Roger's like, no, it caught this part of the line. And they agree to replay the point. It was supposed to be one all by this point, right? It's over. Like, that ball has sailed long, according to the official call. No, because Federer, from 40 love, when he serves the next time on the replay point, there's of course like a backhand error into the net. So that's 40-15. And then I remember looking at you, Adi, and you were like, no, if he fucking like loses this game from here, I'm leaving this pub. And the next point, he's really casual. Like, there's this put away volley, he slides into it and hammers it into the net, 40-30. And then Rafa is at the net for the next point to, make a deuce. And you knew this match is swinging right there. Adi, Kaushik, whoever wants to take this?
Yeah, I mean, go on, Kaushik. I've just blocked this out of my head, and I trust I had to remember shit like this.
I had blocked this out of my head. And I remember this whole game. I think Navratilova and McEnroe were on commentary, and they were not bothered about commentating on the play itself. It was assumed that Federer, it's going to be 1-1 in the second set, and they are talking about all other things. And then suddenly they realized that, hey, Federer is down a break point because he's dumped a put away volley into the net. And then they remember that Nadal suddenly fist pumping, and he's brought out all his celebration, which is away throughout the first set, and then it ends with a backhand passing shot with Federer stranded neither in or near the net or at the baseline, and it's over. I wanted to switch off the TV then at that point of time.
Yeah, when have we seen that before? Federer getting sort of passed by Nadal's backhand. That second set was pretty surreal, because if what Iyer said is true, I must have really lost my shit at that point. Because, I mean, deep inside, you know when the momentum turns. And with Rafa's case, though, it's rubbed in your face that the momentum has turned, because the guy is literally bursting out of the screen. And of course, even my hatred for him at that point was the maximum, because, to love someone, you had to hate the other rival. So it was one of those things. And when Rafa sort of came back in that second set and, won it by an identical scoreline, which was 6-1, I had a very similar, very familiar feeling in my, sick feeling in my gut, which had just happened a year ago in the 2005 semi, I think, which Iyer and me talked about a couple of episodes ago. It felt very familiar, because by then you knew that Federer had reached a point where, of course, mentally he was fragile against Rafa on clay, and especially because he was playing a left-hander, and he really could not handle that Rafa's serve sort of angling away from him all the time. And you knew that Federer had reached a point where I don't think he could play any better, because the ball was bouncing, like his backhands made it seem like the balls were bouncing higher than ever before, unlike the first set. And you knew that Nadal had sort of figured him out again. And, I was actually pretty surprised that despite all this, and we'll come to that, despite all this, the fourth set, you saw a very different Federer, a guy who really didn't give up. Yeah, he didn't give up.
I was going to make that point too, just when you were finishing, which was unlike a lot of these matches, and including the 2005 semifinal, where, you know, once Rafa, the momentum is clearly with him, like it's, you kind of know that Federer is going to fall off at this point, you know, way, very similar to how Federer's opponents kind of like fall off once, you know, two sets are very evenly matched. And then in the third, like, Federer pulls away just after the other guy had a chance, like Agassi had a chance in the US, or Bogdatis had a chance in Melbourne. And you know, once he could not really do much with that chance and he blows it, you know, Federer's going to run away with it. Very similar with Nadal. Yeah. It did not happen here. Federer stayed on, and especially in that fourth, especially in the fourth. We'll come to it. Just one more point. When Federer loses the set 6-1, he's lost yet another set in a slam final, but until this point, not counting the French Open, he had lost all of three sets in seven slam finals.
Whoa.
And now Nadal has to win three sets in the next four, right? Like when he was down 1-6. Yeah. So he was really up against it. You could kind of see why neither wanted to be the favorite coming in also, because, you know, Federer was like, you know, as these guys drummed it up right through the broadcast, he was up against history and all of that. First guy since Lever to hold all four, but like even greater because he was going to do it on all different surfaces. And Nadal, of course, like already the king of clay by that point. I just wanted you guys to like talk about that also a little more, which is just what Nadal was up against, despite him being the favorite. Is he the favorite? Is he the underdog? What is it, guys?
RD, you want to take that?
I mean, as I said, he was like, we knew his streak, right? It was what, 59 straight clay court matches by now.
Yeah.
And sort of his second Grand Slam final. And by now, a lot of us also sort of figured that, and in, this is including the commentators who were commentating, because a lot of us sort of assumed that this is going to be Nadal's slam for the near future, but he's not really going to make a lot of headway on the other surfaces, even though he had a win over Federer by now on the hard court. So, I mean, it was sort of, you know, Nadal was up against it in the sense this was only his second Grand Slam final. And, you know, he wasn't the machine that he became over the next few years. Because we were yet to see, I feel like a lot of it was also down to our perception of him, because 2006 was still early days and we were yet to see him play the way he did on Wimbledon, because according to me, Nadal sort of adapted to grass faster than, say, Federer adapted to Nadal's game on clay. Because Federer was a great clay court player, there's no doubt about that. He was almost the complete player on this surface. So, you know, I wouldn't say that Nadal was the outright favorite heading into this match. I just thought that, and given that Federer had won seven slams in the row, finals in a row, and that start is pretty amazing that he lost only three sets on the way, and he was going to now lose three sets in a row. You could see, you know, exactly what we were discussing earlier. You could see that getting to Federer's head, because, you know, it's like literally you're basically running away like the wind most of the time, and suddenly you come up against something you don't have answers to. And Federer normally just throws away the match at that point. You know, he starts looking into the stands, he starts doing these funny things with his racket, these funny gestures after a serve, before a serve. He starts, you know, very dismissively taking the towels from the ball girls and the ball boys. So, you know the body language. And the only reason we did see Federer fight back the way he did in the fourth set is because Federer was still very unfamiliar to losing to Nadal so often by now. He had lost a couple of times, but Nadal still didn't have a mental stranglehold over him.
It's true. I mean, this may be actually a poor comparison, but the whole vibe going into this French Open final was, yeah, Federer was unbeaten in seven slam finals, but Federer gave a very Roddick vibe, if I may say so, because through that Monte Carlo, Rome, and then Paris leg, he kept saying, "Yeah, I'm getting closer," and you could see it also. Okay, he took a set off Nadal in Monte Carlo, and then he had match points against Nadal. So in a five setter in Rome, and you actually believed him. Okay, so yeah, this guy's won seven slams, and he's getting closer and closer, and the whole narrative post-Rome is that, okay, he has the tools to beat Rafa on clay. So yeah, and then he has this whole aura around him, you know, that this guy has not lost a slam final and Rafa has never defended a slam. So you actually sort of believed him just like you believed Roddick later in the year. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm just having a really good time listening to this analysis from the Fed guys, right? Because it's spot on. This is exactly what it was. Just Federer perhaps not believing that like he could come back at that point after it being one set all. Him just, you know, having just conceded a set the way he had against three other guys in seven finals. And still not believing that he can kind of win two out of the next three, which showed as well. But the fourth was really tight. And there was that one point, can we skip there already or do we build up to the fourth a little quick?
We should totally talk about the fourth because for me, the third was sort of a blur in the sense that Federer was sort of broken early and he didn't really come back from it. He never came back from a lot of sets once he was broken early. But the fourth is definitely, and I know exactly what point you mean also.
Of course. That crazy one at three with Rafa serving 3-5. But also, okay, fine. So if we do want to talk about the fourth, the one point that I want to raise before we get there, and I'm sure one of us will get there at some point, is Rafa making his first error. At 4-3-30 love, that's the eighth game, right? I mean, this is just like as one-sided as it gets. He broke Federer very early on, right? Like in the set. So he's about to go 5-3 up at this point, and that's when he chips one into the net. That's what I have written down. That's his first error that I saw in that set.
Yeah. I remember Stad saying that Federer had 9 unforced errors to Rafa's 0 at some point in the set. I don't know how deep that was, but given Federer's error rate by then, I'd say it was about the fourth game or third or fourth game because he's pretty much making errors quite a bit by then. And as we know, he was broken very early in the fourth too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's actually quite interesting that that Federer also changes his game a little in the fourth. And so what happens is now you see him playing as deep behind the baseline as Rafa is. It's no longer Federer standing, hugging the baseline and, you know, kind of stepping it in. It's a variation of his, it was actually strange to me even watching it back then in 2006, because in Rome, he was coming in on the backhand, which kind of surprised Rafa. And here, he did neither of that. I mean, once he dropped that set in the second set, he started playing passively on the backhand side. And it looked like, you know, he's just going to go through the motions. But surprisingly, Federer kind of changing his own game and indulging himself in a bit of clay court rallying with Rafa was quite a surprise.
This is often what RD calls back against the world tennis for Roger, right? Like when he has almost nothing to lose. You kind of sometimes see, or he has, you know, like, you know, the match is over in both circumstances, like on either side of the spectrum, you see him really play like the way he would have liked to play in a practice match. And this, it happened right there at, you know, when he's serving to stay in the match at 3-5, you suddenly see him work out the puzzle for himself in many ways, right? Where... he's taking the ball really early. This is, of course, before he started doing the classic clay court stuff, like you mentioned, Kosh, where he's taking early. He's, like, again, like great rhythm on his backhand. He's not trying to run Rafa ragged at this point, right? Just yet. Yeah. Quite the opposite. Keeping his shots really short. Pulling the trigger on his winners very, very early in the rally and gets it to 5-4. RD.
This is when I think Rafa was serving for the match at 5-3, right?
So Federer is serving to kind of like stay in the match at 3-5. Rafa is serving to serve out the match at 5-4.
At 5-4. Okay, right. Yeah. So at I think this point was a 30-all 5-3, right? Where sort of the commentators simply go that this is the best defensive point Federer has ever played in his career. Because that was some defensive point. And I have never seen Federer sort of scramble on clay the way, because when I was watching it again, my jaw dropped to the floor because it felt like the roles were changed for a bit, because you'd normally see Federer sort of in the front seat and the other guy always scrambling to survive in the match. And I'd never seen Federer. Basically, it made it very obvious to me, and it made me sadder that you know, Federer had this, he had this level to reach at some point when he wanted to. It's just that Rafa never really gave him the opportunity to reach this level so often. Because this point, honestly, I've never seen him play, sort of defend and chase a point like this. It involved all kind of shots. Like, there were drop shots, there were lobs, there were, like, Federer was running, like, from both sides of the court. And it really felt like it was lost a couple of times. And and that was when I felt like, okay. And I remember also back in 2006 when we were watching it, that when Federer broke back after all this, I sort of felt that, you know, this is going to go the Rome way now.
Gosh.
No, that's exactly my thoughts, that, you know, I was thinking, okay, this is... but at the same time, I was also, I don't want a Rome heartbreak in the French Open final. If he is to lose, please lose in four. Don't lose in the fifth. It wouldn't have been good for my health back then.
Oh, man, little did you know how much would go against our health.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, Nadal has gone from 4 points away at 3-5 with Federer serving to now serving to, like, push this set into a tiebreak at 5-6. I have never seen him under so much pressure, especially after that point that RD just described. You know, the one where Rafa yanks him from side to side like a rag doll, man. Like, some 5-6 times, backhand, forehand, backhand, forehand, like ad court, deuce court, ad court, deuce court. And then somehow induces the Rafa error, which is almost impossible to see. And it was also quite crazy to see the crowd kind of, like, love Federer like that, right? Because it's obviously flipped now with Rafa, a 13-time champion, or when he was on his way to his 12th or 13th. What is it? How many does he have, man? 12?
13. I'm not sure.
Yeah. 12?
Like, everyone's just lost count, dude.
You'll have to count his other slams and then add up to 19.
So 2017, when he beat Stan, was his decima. Okay. And then he beat Thiem twice. So 12. Fine. So yeah, on his way to his 12th, where he beat Federer in the semi-final of Roland Garros last year. Federer had no support at all. But this was kind of crazy, right? Like, with Rafa 5-6 down, serving to stay in the set, and the crowd basically not just rooting for Federer, but also rooting for a fifth set. That kind of pressure, I don't think Rafa has ever been on before or after on that surface. I mean, on that surface in Paris, right? Mm-hmm. And you could see, like, everything was against him. Everything. Like, momentum gone. Right? The crowd, he's lost. Everyone wants a fifth, and everyone wants Roger to win that fifth also. And I was watching this so carefully to see, like, what gives. Like, how does Rafa still win from here? And then it was, of course, fucking Federer's backhand, dude. Like, what else? Like, what else gives him, gives, like, just picks a pin in all this pressure?
Yeah, I mean, I have the luxury of hindsight to say now that, you know, it's really admirable that Rafa never really quit that strategy for the next 10 years, honestly. Like, across surfaces, he loses a set here. But he knows for a fact that he loses sets because he makes his own mistakes. It's not because the strategy is wrong or that he's lacking the passion or the stamina. It's just that he knows that sometimes he's a little too nervous. Because I remember at the beginning of this match when we were witnessed one of the first times to that pre-match routine before the toss, where Rafa is, like, sort of jumping around like a mad animal while Federer is just looking at him saying, what the hell are you doing? The photographer is basically, you know, ready to take pictures with them on both sides of the court. Even the commentators found that very amusing. And I thought that Rafa had so much pent up energy by that point, because, you know, I felt like, and, you know, as Iyer, you very rightly pointed out, that the pressure was nothing he had ever faced before. Because, of course, he was a bit of a wild card the previous year. Nobody knew him. Nobody expected him to win the French Open the way he did. And by now, you know, that pressure was starting to show. And despite that, the guy still went to Federer's backhand. He was just pounding his backhand in the tiebreak like it was just another game. And, you know, even midway through the tiebreak, I remember I had lost hope, because I was like, there is no way Federer is going to keep jumping to make those shots back. He's going to sort of lose interest in one of the shots. He's going to shank another one. And, you know, as we know it, that's exactly what happened.
Gosh.
Yeah. It's true that I think Rafa even writes in that book that, you know, he would, at any given time in the match, he would, you know, his first instincts against Roger is to hit to the backhand. I was just looking at the stats on this one. It's incredible. I don't think, so in this final, Rafa has served 93% of his serve to his Federer's backhand. I don't think even this, he would have done this in any of his other games as well. It was just taking a weakness and then relentlessly hammering it in. Yeah.
Sure. But again, like, man, there is this one, it can really work as a reason if Roger really had to give a reason to why he just persisted with that weird, like, amalgamation of a drop shot comes short slice backhand. You know the shot I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
It's also because, like, Rafa is standing 240 meters behind the baseline, right? And then they're having, like, this longish butterfly rally. And Federer, of course, like, wants to take that chance and drop him. And it never goes in. Like, never. Because he's anyway slicing that backhand mostly, right? When he's not skipping around it. In this case, the idea is, I mean, the tactic is spot on, and it happens in the tiebreak. It basically doesn't work in his favor in the tiebreak, but I can see why he tries to do it. He tries to basically pull Rafa all the way ahead before, like, you know, possibly lobbing him or passing him or whatever, if he reaches the ball in the first place. He's a fabulous runner. Rafa almost never, like, by the time Rafa started charging ahead and he would reach the baseline, the ball would be against the tape or whatever. Like, it never worked for him. Like, not a single time. Like, I wish Tony Roach or someone looked at him and, like, winked at him, or, you know, some message. He was so against, like, on-court coaching. He really needed it, man. Sometimes someone needed to tell him on court that, boss, this is just not working. I can see why you're a genius and why you're trying to do this, but you're not able to execute it. Now, what to do?
I think a lot of it is down to the fact that it used to work against so many other players, because if you notice, they were really thrown off by Federer's slice and how odd it was, and how sort of this hybrid shot that you're mentioning, it really used to work. I can tell you that I started getting frustrated with this shot in our very first podcast where we discussed Safin, the semi-final last year. That's when the shot started really annoying me, because, and I, as you very rightly said, I really got annoyed with the fact that he didn't find the need to change this strategy, or not even a strategy, this instinct, when he was facing Rafa on any surface, no matter, because Rafa was a different angle, he was a different dimension, he was a left-hander. By now, you'd think that Federer would be flexible enough. And of course, Tony Roach, and, you know, we can talk as much as we want about Federer's coaching staff and all, but we know over the years that is just more of mental bolstering than actually making changes to his game so much. And that shot really frustrated me in his initial years, because I always felt like he had all those tools and he was pretty much winning every slam he was participating in. And that's why his weaknesses, like this particular shot or a particular way of sort of returning the serve, used to stand out a lot more. The weaknesses used to be a little more glaring. And no coach changed that over the years till, I'd say, as far as 2017, when he really had no choice but to change.
Who's that? Edberg?
Sorry, what?
Edberg.
Yeah. That coach?
Edberg, I think, put before that. I think, No, but what is actually frustrating here is, Eric, in hindsight, when I look back again, I must go back to that Rome final, because I still think it's the best final that Roger has played on. I mean, best game that Roger has played on clay, simply because his first shot on the backhand used to be a punchier variant down the line to Rafa's backhand, and several points he set up by charging into the net and kind of trying to finishing off the points. It was interesting because Rafa was asked about this very backhand at the end of the Rome final, and he said and he admitted to being surprised by that tactic of Federer's. And then from going from there to playing that, what I thought was a very passive hybrid in between chip slash drive shot was, yeah, quite annoying.
Yeah, no, excellently put. Yes. So that's it. I think, are we done with it? Does anyone want to do match point? RD?
No, not really. The match point wasn't really. I mean, it was just another Nadal point where he was just yanking Federer to the back of the court so far that Federer was pretty much in the crowd by the time Nadal was sort of fell onto the clay and got himself all soiled, like he was bleeding or something. And I hate that image more than anything else.
There is something about that image I love almost more than anything else. Yeah, this is called like fucking opposites, because there is something about that really sweaty young Nadal, kind of like getting mud all over his body and then wanting to go and hug everyone inside, right? Like you could see Federer didn't want to touch him at the net. He was already pissed off. Then this guy, like Wimbledon, he wants to climb up and then go and meet like every member of his family who are sitting in two rows. Uncle Tony in one row, and then after that he'll go past like some 20 other people, all of them like patting him on the back, like making mud fly here and there, and then like all his uncles, all his father's brothers, his father, his mother, and then he'll come back down again. There's just something about that routine that is as like unique to Rafa as his game, man. I mean, he just took that and he owned it.
Wow, Iyer, you really made that sound very erotic, after a while. I started to wonder if it was about tennis anymore.
Yeah, possibly wasn't also. Anyway, do you guys have anything to add to Rafa rolling in the mud? Gosh, I'm sure you have something to say there. Artie hates it.
Hi. No.
I clearly borderline beyond love, so
No, I didn't like it at all. I'm with RD on this. At that point, I was like, what the hell? Who does all this? And this image of Federer as this proper I completely bought into all of that, and then I can see Federer waiting by the net, and he just wants to have this handshake and get out of there, while he's already thinking, okay, that's loss number four in the year for him against Nadal, and he hasn't lost to any other player. And now the first Grand Slam final loss as well.
Yeah, pretty much all those records were like sort of such a huge dent in his records, because he lost only five all year if you think about it. And this was thankfully the last loss to Nadal all year. But I mean, if you heard him in the sort of post-match interview on court, I'd also like to point out before we finish that I did find Federer was a lot more expressive with his disgust back in the interviews in those early days, because he was still, of course, he was invincible by then, and you could sense the chip on his shoulder, and I mean that in a good way. You could sense it by then. So when the interviewer was sort of quizzing him on a particular point in the third set, where Federer sort of threw away a game that he should have come back and broken Nadal back in that game, and he just threw it away. Even Federer was like, I just don't know why I didn't make that forehand. It's my favorite shot. The forehand down the line, I pretty much is my bread and butter. On any other day, I would have made it. And he sounded so disappointed that I was actually happy to see that, because over the years he's become a little too dignified in his post-match interviews. Of course, sometimes it really hurts him. You could see it on his face, but his comments are never sort of indicative of how pained he is. And in this, was, of course, the beginning of a lot of pain for the next 3 years. If only he could sort of jump into a time machine and see where he would be in 2009. But yep. I actually found that post-match interview very sort of enlightening in a way.
Oh, by the end of that very year itself.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah, same. I wish he'd also looked at who Rafa played in the first round of this tournament as his ultimate savior. was there in the draw.
Yeah, he was there in the draw. He beat Sauterling in the first round.
Yeah, Rafa beat Sauterling.
Yeah,
he was going to be his savior.
I'm sure we'll dedicate some time, maybe more than an episode or about that for the 2009 French Open as well. But seriously, man, like for the haters who say that Roger didn't really earn his French Open, like they can really go fuck themselves, because he played two incredible five-setters against Haas and Delpo to even get himself to a position where he could put Sodling away in the final. But anyway, we'll get there. Clearly the second best clay courter of our time, of all time. Can we say of all time? No, we can't say of all time. Our time. Anyway.
Huh? Of our time. I wouldn't go as far to say all time.
Well, our time is, unfortunately or fortunately, is almost synonymous with all time, right? With the way these guys are playing. I don't know.
It's true.
Anyway, so Edberg, a very sharp-looking Edberg, comes on court to give away the trophy, and Federer sulks right through it. I think he sulks all the way through Haller, and he smiles only once he's in Wimbledon. And that's going to be our next episode.
Yes. Can't wait to see the RogerFederer.com change to green.
Yeah, totally. Looking forward to a Federer win. So
But stop sulking, dude, because so this is five episodes in a row and we've only spoken Federer matches. We're gonna do Kaushik, I hope you join us for the next one as well, which is of course again Federer at the end of this rainbow, this 1 month rainbow, which kind of constituted the spell between French and Wimbledon, with Federer and Nadal on the other side of it as well. So number six episode wise for us, number six Federer match for us. So
that's actually a compliment. Like, we are pretty much discussing Federer every match, which says a lot about that era. Looking forward to the next one, and see you guys in the next show.
Yeah.
And thanks a lot for joining us, Kosh. I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, I did. Thanks a lot for having me, man.
Thanks. All right. That's it. Thank you.
Bye.